Hi, we're here today with Danny Lohr, the author of The Nasty at Balua. Danny, how are you today?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. So can you tell us a little bit about The Nasty at Balua? Like, what inspired it in particular?
I mean, aside from an obsessive love of werewolves, there was a while back, like a magazine I had decided not to submit it to, but I was looking at what they were doing and I was like, I've never really done like a pulp style like werewolf story before. Like, I write a lot of werewolves and like different situations and like the werewolves meaning different things. But I was like, I've just never done like a fun, like old school, you know, like pulp magazine werewolf story. I'm not sure how fun it turned out, but like that was kind of what I was aiming for.
I think it was pretty amazing. I was really stoked to read it. I was like, oh my God, it's werewolves, which is like my favorite thing. And then in space, and I was like, oh my God, that is the coolest thing ever. You know, at this point, the episode is aired and, you know, we've had a few people listen to it. And there are a lot of people that are really, really excited about it. They're like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. You know, well, werewolves in space, you know, it's something they've never seen before. So, you know, you said that you're really into werewolves, you know, as I am. For you, you know, I feel like werewolves can be a metaphor for so many different things. For you, what are werewolves a metaphor for?
I mean, so there's like two answers to that, because the first answer is very much, having written or tried to write werewolves for so long, some of the fun for me is finding out new and different metaphors for them. I like especially looking for, as much as I love like the old school, you know, like werewolves and vampires, you know, like repressed human emotion and that sort of, or like repressed sexuality, like that's like a classic one. I like starting a new story and finding a different metaphor for them a lot. But very much in recent years, I've been really focused on not so much the werewolf part, but the idea of transformation and the fear of transformation being the center of the metaphor. And I've been writing a lot with that being a representative of anxiety recently. Just like not even necessarily the beast part itself being the focus, but the fear of transformation being a metaphor for anxiety, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a really interesting viewpoint. You know, you don't see that very often. You know, in general, I think anxiety is not explored as often in stories as it could or should be. And yeah, I mean, it makes sense. The anxiety of transformation, you know, it's especially, you know, if you weren't born a werewolf, you know, this is not going to be something that is usual for you, you know, and so there's got to be some anxiety around that. And, you know, using that as a way to explore anxiety is a brilliant idea. See, I knew you were brilliant. Do you have any other werewolf stories that you've written? And, you know, if so, what kind of metaphors have those?
So that's kind of out for the public right now. I've got over at FNIX a story called The Moon and Other Beasts I Keep With Me. Apologies if I'm getting the name of my own story wrong. But that one very much focuses on the idea of not the werewolf itself being a metaphor for appropriation, but using a werewolf story as a way to tell a story about appropriation. It is about a young woman who's wanted to be a writer her whole life, and it's in a world where werewolves aren't known. And as she's, you know, struggling to be a writer and, you know, in a world where she has to tell her story as fiction, an ex-girlfriend who she revealed her werewolf status to decide became famous writing like these new bestsellers that are about this fantasy werewolf world. And she knows very well that much of that story is taken from the secrets that she shared with this ex-girlfriend. And the story is about when she kind of confronts her.
Okay. And you have another story in Fire Literary Magazine, right?
That one's called The Last Exorcist. The theme of that issue is sundown towns. And so that story is basically like a Rolling Stone-esque like biographic article about a character named Naheem who comes from a line of exorcists, but it's right as the U.S. starts passing legislation to make exorcism illegal because white people primarily have been making deals with demons and for possession and to cause actual mystical, forcible sundown towns in order to stay ahead. And so it's Naheem's perspective as he's being interviewed and dealing with the fact that what he does, which he very deeply believes is saving humanity and saving Black people from the rest of humanity in particular is about to be made illegal.
Yeah, I actually remember reading that now. That came out, what, almost a year ago now, I feel like.
Yeah, that was actually my first big published story at all. I have a friend who curates a magazine called Lovers and Other Strangers. It's like a very small print magazine. It's only in print. It was this really cool concept where he took old archival photos and then everyone would be paired off with a story and you would write it and write a story based off a photo. And so I had like one or two stories in there, but like that was very much, I know him and he trusts my writing. Therefore, he printed it. Whereas like Faya was the first time I had ever successfully submitted and sold a story. So that was that story. And it being that story in particular was really important to me.
And, you know, Fire, just like Nightlight, is, you know, focused on Black authors. Totally. All of the stories are written by Black writers. So do you think that, you know, in terms of submitting that story, did you feel more comfortable submitting your story to a Black run, Black only literary magazine? How did that kind of affect your decision to, you know, put yourself out there and try to sell your work?
I mean, Last Exorcist was written specifically for that submission period where I literally, I still have a notebook where I just wrote in the center Faya Sundown Towns and just like brain mapping possible ideas I could have done for it. But that one was really, it was really important for me. Like when I was done, I was looking at the story and kind of double checking that like, I still want to submit this story specifically to Faya as opposed to, you know, any other markets. And it was very scary for me. Because it's only in the past, I want to say 3 years, 3.5 years that I've really thought of myself, not just as like a writer to be, but like as a Black writer. So on one level, it was feeling like, oh, I'm submitting this to my people. And that felt really good. But on the other side, it was the first blatantly political story I'd ever written. It was the first story that I ever wrote that was not just like a monster of the week kind of concept. It was, this is important. This is reflective of what I'm seeing and my frustrations with the world at large and me writing through all of that. So it had its own fears because, you know, since I did not perceive of myself as a writer who writes anything political, like prior to that, really, I didn't know how it would be perceived. I didn't know if it was too much or even if, what if this isn't coming off to say what I thought that I was saying? And I was really scared about that, especially so submitting to, you know, like Black editors where I know the what I'm talking about in that story is, you know, on a metaphoric level, stuff that they're also dealing with. It's the difference between like, I mean, I didn't know any of the editors at the time, but it's very much the difference between like having a stranger read your work versus having someone who knows you and how much scarier that can be.
Yeah, definitely. Did you intend to make that story political? You know, you said you were brainstorming when the theme for that issue came out. Did it start off as something you wanted it to be a political story, or did it just kind of like take that direction?
On a certain level, now looking back, I'm like, there's no way really that a story themed off of Sundown Towns couldn't be on a certain level. But in terms of like intentional politics, once I knew that I was writing the story about The Exorcist, I knew that it was political. I did not know when I was sitting down to write the story how, like, to come up with a story how political it would be. I knew that once I had conceived of Naheem and his world, that like there was never any way I could tell that story without being political, especially not just in terms of the world where there's this political element to possession and demons and this racial element, but also when writing it and I was working on Naheem and I want him very much to just be that character that's like, screw you. I don't care if you like what's coming out of my mouth, but I'm going to try my best to save you, which I feel like also is like me trying to deal with like the concept of like respectability politics in a story. Once I knew he wasn't necessarily a nice person, but he was a good person, I knew that there was no way to avoid politics.
Right. And I think you did it successfully, you know, in my opinion.
Thank you very much.
You know, honestly, like as a writer, that's a hard thing to pull off. you know, is you don't want to be like super in your face political, where, you know, people are like, well, you know, this isn't a good, you know, quote unquote escape for me, you know, because they want to read as entertainment, not to have to necessarily actively think about all the wrongdoing in the world. But then they also want to read so that they can sort of make that wrongdoing in the world make sense in their minds. And towing that line is really difficult, I think, as a writer, but you certainly did it successfully.
Yeah, it was interesting when it first came out, because, you know, it was the first story that I'd ever written that had, you know, like kind of wide enough spread to get like actual like reviews and like comments on it on that level, you know, ignoring, you know, goofball fan fiction stuff, but like the first serious piece I'd really written. And there had been a piece in that story in particular where I think it was a fake quote from like a PhD piece talking about like politics and resistance that I had made up for the story. And when I had been writing it and submitting it, I was constantly paranoid that that part was too explicit. Like, I was like, this is the part that anytime someone's going to read, they're going to be like, it's too extra, you know, like. But it was weird to me because when people were commenting on it, that was probably the line most quoted as people's favorites, which was like a really trippy experience for me because I was so scared about being so blunt with the politics in the story and with the message and opinion. And that was the part that resonated the most. And I feel like that was a really big lesson for me as a writer, that being that explicit sometimes is okay.
And I think, you know, also, so, you know, before we started talking, you know, and recording this, we were talking about the Fireside Fiction Report and, you know, how there are some magazines that haven't published anything from Black writers in the last year. How do you think that affects you, you know, one as a writer, but also as a reader?
I feel like it's something that has been affecting me since I started reading and writing, you know, that it's not something that is just this year. In fact, I would say that, and this like sounds really like cynical in a certain way, but I am so used to those, to like, not those specific magazines, obviously, but to the magazines that tell the genre stories, to publishers that tell genre stories, to not seeing myself, that I am more thrown and more shaken and more affected as a reader and writer when I see myself than when I don't. I would probably say, I mean, Faya's existence revitalizes me and is more important to me, you know, Nightlight's existence. Back when I read Victor Laval's Ballad of Black Tom, and when I read Daniel Jose Older's Shadow Shaper, like those moments where I was like, oh, I'm so used to people not wanting to see what it is that I'm trying to do that seeing other people do it stays with me longer. You know, like there is a certain level of now when I write a story and I don't have a specific market for it, knowing that these are places that like maybe the only Black stories they've told were reprints, you know, if that, you know, like that'll make me wonder whether they will ever want a story that I submit, because I like to think of myself as a pretty good writer. I am not the best that's out there right now, you know, so it's like if they haven't grabbed on some of the amazing pieces of work that I know have to be being submitted, that I know that are out there, you know, or they're driving away writers who don't feel that this is their place. Is it worth my energy getting my heart broken, trying to put my stories in those markets when I could instead be working on markets that see me?
And I think, you know, that's something that I struggle with as a writer as well, is, you know, especially with the current political climate and everything, it's hard to put yourself out there and submit work to places that, you know, may not even get what you've written, may not be open to what you've written. So how has that affected how often you submit now as a writer and sort of what your career plans are going forward for your writing?
I specifically look for places that look for me. Like, I'm not sitting and waiting for those places to appear, but I'm looking for that language of people looking for Black stories, looking for queer stories, looking for stories with non-binary leads, you know, like places. I'm looking for places that are run by people of color, by queer people of color, etc. But even if they're not places that are going, we want more voices, you know, and then I'm looking and seeing 3, 6, 9 months down the line from them saying that, are they backing up their talk with publishing? You know, that I'm looking for places and people that perk up when I say that I'm doing Black work, when I'm doing queer Black work, and not hoping to convince people that queer Black work is important, but having dialogue with people who already think it is.
Right. Working with the willing.
Yeah. You know, like if down the line, these people who are not willing, who are not listening, you know, eventually open up, you know, like to genuinely listening to and spreading the work of, you know, like queer Black creators, then, you know, all right, I'll give, you know, like I'll give it a try. But submitting work is so stressful to begin with. I am a very anxious person. I do my very best once I've submitted a story to a market to forget about it. So the second that I'm reminded that it exists, it's, you know, like a terrifying process. So I'd rather cut out the element of, do they even like Black writers? You know, I can't emotionally afford to deal with that, especially not in this climate, both politically, where there's so many people who don't want to hear us, but also there's so many people doing so much good work and who want to put people out there. So why not, even if they don't accept my work because they're getting so much good work, I'd rather put my energy into promoting and boosting that than trying to make myself not invisible for people.
If it's all right with you, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your identity as a queer, non-binary person. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
So can you tell us a little bit about your experience, particularly as a queer writer?
I was out as a lesbian back in high school. So I've been out with that part of my identity for a very long time. It's definitely a part of my identity that I'm far more comfortable dealing with, I guess, publicly, just because I feel like I'm at the point where I have all the vocabulary necessary to describe it to people, to describe my experience, where it's only been, I want to say about 2 years or so, where I've started to have the vocabulary to talk about myself as non-binary and what that means. I use non-binary, or I tend to use just queer in general more often, because my perception of my gender is kind of ever changing, which, you know, may have something to do with my love of shapeshifters. But in the way that, like, I perceive of the character that is me in my stories is almost always, like, usually is, again, like I said, like, this is still me coming to my vocabulary, will typically be non-binary or often be cis male, and that's for like a few different reasons involving my ever-changing use of pronouns, etc. But I feel like it's always a part of my stories, because it took me so long to come to any sort of like understanding of myself as non-binary. So like, it's always an element. I haven't gotten to the point where I feel fully comfortable on like a bigger scale piece using a non-binary protagonist, but I feel that that's just because my responsibility as a writer is to do as little harm as possible. And I think that while, at least for me, while I'm discovering myself, there's a lot of potential for falling into tropes, for falling into messy language, for, you know, misusing a metaphor and like hurting a reader. And I'm like, that's not the point. You know, so there's almost always in any of my stories, there's a character that, like, if they're not non-binary, or they're not written explicitly as non-binary, I could probably envision myself writing them coming out at some point in the future. But that's also just, again, where I am as both a writer and an individual. And I hope to make that more explicit in my stories sooner rather than later.
You know, I'd like to go back to what you said about, you know, your responsibility as a writer to do no harm. You know, that's kind of something, sounds a bit like, you know, the Hippocratic Oath for doctors. And I think a lot of writers, you know, really don't take that seriously. And I find it interesting that, you know, even though you are non-binary, you know, you still haven't quite found your way around the language for that. And so you're kind of avoiding writing about that at this point. How do you feel about the literature that's out there right now for non-binary people, you know, in terms of what's available to read and what's accurate, what's not accurate? And what do you feel like your responsibility is toward putting something out there that other people like you can see themselves in?
Again, because I'm still, you know, dealing with my own vocabulary, I don't like thinking about in terms of accurate and not accurate, because I know that non-binary can be such an umbrella for people. I know that what non-binary means when I use it to describe myself does not necessarily mean the same thing to someone else who might use the same term. But I think that a lot of non-binary creators are doing some really great work out there and doing a lot of great reviewing of work out there. I know that when I was first starting to explore and understand the blogger and writer Corey Alexander's suggestions were really helpful in terms of looking for books. They also do a lot of really dope reviews and seek out reviews of a lot of trans characters, which is really appreciated. There was a book that they recommended to me early on called A Boy Called Sin by Cecil Wilde, I believe is the author. That is a romance between a young trans man and a character, Tom, an older man who, during the course of the story, comes to realize that they are non-binary and what that means, which was, it's a great story. I absolutely adore it, and I recommend it heavily. There's what was really important to me, a good friend of mine, Vita Ayala, wrote an issue of Supergirl that introduced a Black non-binary teenager as the one of the main characters of the issue. And that was really important to me, seeing a non-binary creator at, you know, like DC Comics writing a non-binary character, you know. But there's a lot of work, and I am very sorry that I don't have a longer list of creators, just because I'm very bad at lists of names. I will try to come up with some and recommend some online for sure.
Yeah. So you guys make sure that you follow Danny online on Twitter at WereDawgz, WereDawgz. What kind of impact do you think that would have had on you to read something like that as a child?
There are a lot of ideas like queerness, like being trans, that withholding them from kids does more damage than it does simplifying the world for them. Withholding it, even if they end up never questioning their identity, you know, like it's very much, you are making it harder for them to relate to other people in the world, you know, and that makes both their future experiences and the future experiences of the people that they encounter more painful. I can't even imagine what it would have been like to have stories where kids get to explore their identity in that way as a kid. Like, it's just literally so different than what my experience was, you know, like it's, but like in that sort of, I can't imagine, wow, sort of way, you know, not like in a negative way, but in a very much like, my experience was very much, okay, but what if I closed my eyes and woke up tomorrow and got to be, for, you know, the dorkiest example, you know, got to be Gambit, you know, like for a day, what would that feel like? How, you know, like, but like literally, I would love a world where when a kid said, this name doesn't fit my body, or these pronouns don't fit how I feel or who I am, you know, because how I feel and who I am, I feel like, can sometimes be two different statements, that normalizing exploration can't be bad. Not if the exploration in and of itself does not hurt anybody, you know? And it's okay, because there are a lot of children who this will like change their lives and make them so much happier and healthier in their bodies. And then there are kids who will explore and experiment and decide, this isn't for me. And that happens, and that's okay. But it's a lot more stressful to get all of these questions, you know, in your late 20s, in your 30s, 40s, 50s, for the first time, especially when, like, most people are at a stage at that point where they thought they were kind of, they knew who they were. Let people explore these questions when they're developing and growing, you know, instead of having to go through this five more times, you know. But that's just my opinion.
I agree. And so whether you're, you know, potentially transgender or, you know, queer in any way, like, I think everyone needs to read about these experiences, because I think that understanding what it is like to be someone else, you know, who may be dealing with different circumstances than you, is the way that we find our way to empathy.
Yeah, I definitely agree, you know, like, and I think, you know, this ties back to the conversation of there being all these, you know, like, these magazines that, like, don't print, like, new Black writers. And I think that it's very much a cycle, you know, like, if you don't seek out this writing, you never come to understand it. If you never come to understand it, you can't identify it as, you can't identify the good work in the slush pile. If you can't identify it, it never gets published. And it's like this cycle, you know? And there are some writers out there who, you know, work really great out of spite. I've done it occasionally where, like, I write some stories literally because I'm angry that I'm not seeing myself places. But most people can't work like that. And even those who do write out of spite, that's a lot of energy. It's a lot of energy to keep up. And you can't, well, most people can't keep that up for the long stretch, you know?
Especially if you're an anxious person, you know, I think. You know, there are anxious people that, you know, tend to hold that anxiety in. And then there are anxious people that tend to get angry and then use that energy to create things. And, you know, both of those are valid. You know, it's just who you are. But yeah, I'm definitely one of those anxious people that gets angry and then uses anger.
Like, I used to be able to do it back when I was writing fan fiction pretty heavily. If I would see something and I would get really angry that, like, about characterization or the ignoring of this character or something like that. But it's because, like, fan fiction, like, when I was posting it, I was always posting it for free. I was always just posting it to get a couple of comments and then feel better and get it out. But, like, when you're submitting places and you're hoping that you get paid, when you're submitting places and there's publishers involved and, you know, agents and all of that, it's such a different level of stress that, like, I find it's far more difficult to maintain that kind of the rage writing in my original work, as opposed to, you know, like, in fan fiction or stuff that I'm just writing that I just think a couple of friends are going to see, because there's the stakes aren't there, you know, but the stakes are there even if you're just submitting, you know, like, if you're submitting to a place that doesn't have Black writers and then you get picked, like, one, that would be wonderful, but on the flip side, that's a lot of pressure for that writer, you know? Like, there is going to be the first debut writer in one of these magazines, you know, like, Black debut writers, and that writer is going to have a lot of stress because they are held up as the first that did that. We see this all the time, you know, like, the first Black person to do X. That's so much stress and responsibility put on these people's shoulders who are just trying to do, just trying to have a career, you know? And it's just like, I can't keep that anger up. That's what therapy and my cat is for. I don't.
Yeah. I mean, anger, I think, is, you know, it's a, for me anyway, it's a great impetus to start something, but anger is a fuel that burns very quickly. And, you know, once that anger is gone, you have to have something else in its place to sustain that motivation, to sustain that same energy, even if it isn't anger. You've got to replace it with something to continue the work. So you said that you started off, did you start off writing fan fiction? Was that the first thing that you ever wrote?
I mean, I've been writing since I was a wee child. my first quote unquote stories were literally me with my mom's magazines, flipping pages and making them tell a story. But, like, I was always writing a combination of, like, fan fiction and original work. I think I discovered fan fiction back in, like, 7th, 8th grade, where it was a particular escape for me because I went to a very, very, very white high school. Like, like I was like a scholarship student at like a private school and was feeling very, very out of touch with the rest of my classmates. I kind of felt that way through most of my time there, you know, especially since I was also like a comic reading genre loving nerd, which was not really the wave with my classmates.
In a number of ways, you were kind of, you know, over in the margins.
Yeah, and like kind of didn't have much to relate to them with. So when I discovered, it was literally discovering like a random like Buffy fan fiction site, like finding like these communities where I could share writing and it could be as bizarre as I wanted it to be. I, you know, like that I could just work on engaging these stories that I was already loving and already interested in. And then people would respond immediately, you know, like I'd been writing original stuff, you know, like mini horror stories in the back of like my elementary school classes and stuff like that. But like, this was the first time that I could get my stories out there and they could be weird. They could be genre, you know, where as I was still, my high school was the sort that if you had writing classes, you know, like fiction writing classes, it had to be all non-genre, except you got one time during the year that you could write a genre story that you wanted to write, you know, which was always my favorite project of the year, you know, but then also everyone being a little weird and awkward because they didn't know how to respond to it, you know, but like I never had that with fan fiction. So like that kind of got me back to writing in general for a very long time. Even when I would go through periods where I wasn't posting it, you know, like it was just a full escape. And then going back to writing, when I was, you know, like with my partner, we would just write for hours and hours together. It's never stuff like we posted anywhere, but like I kept writing. And then eventually when I was like in those kind of like fandom spheres back on like Tumblr before I deleted that thing, I met one of my best friends in the world because he posted like this really awesome like sci-fi picture, soldiers and mechs. And I was just like, can I write a story? And it became like the first draft of a novel. That's like, so I've kind of always been writing, but fan fiction was my home for a very long time.
So what kind of led you to decide to start writing, you know, on a more professional level and creating more original work?
I always wanted to do it. Actually, when I was younger, I would always, my big role model was not any real writer, but Lois Lane. I thought that I was going to go to Columbia for journalism because I didn't really understand that journalism path is a completely separate path from fiction writing. Turns out I would make a terrible journalist, but like just awful. But it was always what I wanted to do. But for a very long time, just being beaten down by the fact that I wrote genre, and not only did I write genre, but being Black, being, you know, queer, I for a very long time didn't see it as a possibility anymore. Like I always wanted to write professionally, but I didn't know how to get in. I didn't understand how story submissions worked. I didn't have people in my life that like did that. And then when I started after college working in a comic shop, the same comic shop I still work in because I love them. I love Forbidden Planet to death. And I had a lot of coworkers who now are full-time writers, you know, like some very good friends who like comics is what they do. And starting from there and being actually part of communities of writers, you know, like, then I was like, I could try doing this again, you know? And then I went through a place where I was like, I had these drafts of novels that I was working on, but like, I didn't know what to do with them really. Like I didn't know how to make them ready. And it's very weird because I feel like the switch to Twitter was really helpful to me. Like I had spent a lot of time in like the fandoms of Tumblr, but the switch to Twitter, being able to communicate with other people who were like doing that writing hustle, you know, like I think that I found out about Faya and immediately fell in love. Like the second that, you know, subscriptions were available for that first year, like I bought a full year subscription. I think I remember, I want to say it was L. I could be incorrect, but I want to say that it was L talking about, you know, like being like, hey, if there, you know, right after I think the first issue being like, hey, if there are any, you know, Black writers, you know, like who need support. And I guess that day my anxiety like had gone on vacation because I actually like DM'd her.
Yep. I remember that. Same for me.
Yep. I was like, I've never done this before, but I guess it's happening, you know? And then, you know, finding a community of Black writers who, you know, I mean, kick my butt on the daily if I'm not, you know, writing or giving me permission to be too stressed out. And finding out about markets and being able to talk and being like, is this just me? Or, you know, like, is this a race thing? Is this, even if I don't need to talk about it, being comfortable enough knowing that there's a group of people I can talk to really makes a difference. Because I'm very good at talking for a very long time, in case it's not clear, but knowing how to implement things in terms of my writing career is something that I've only really come to in like the past 2 years. Like, I remember reading something years ago where they were talking about like most writers, you know, like it's post 30, you know, post 40 or whatever. But I really truly feel like I hit 30 and then 100 things just started clicking into place. And I hope that they continue to.
So speaking of things clicking into place and hoping they continue to, what would you love to happen for your career as a writer in the next year or two?
Wow. The silence is only because there's such a long list of things. I want to write comics really badly. I would love to be getting more of my long form stuff out in front of editors. I'm working on edits for a manuscript that's really near and dear to my heart. And I want before year's end to be putting it in front of editors with my agent. I'm really hoping that. I want to, man, see, there's so much stuff. I just want to try as much as possible. Within a year, I'd love, like, not by the end of the year, but within a year, I'd love to be, like, in a place where I can start researching, really, like, getting into game writing, either video games or tabletop. There's spheres that are very near and dear to me. And I just always really loved the idea of writing like those flavor short stories in like a role-playing book, you know, like I've always found myself looking at like role-playing books, reading all of those first and then going back and reading the rules. So I would love to do that.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I used to always get made fun of because I went back and read all the rules for everything, but I kicked everybody's ass in the game because I read the book, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've always enjoyed, one of the first things that was ever my nerdy collection of things are like the old school World of Darkness books, like the Vampire the Masquerade old books. I still have a shelf just like full of them.
Oh, share a picture of them on Twitter, please.
I will share some of those. Like, I literally just have like a shelf of just like the old, you know, vampire. I got like that Blackbound Vampire the Masquerade that came out with a couple years ago, the old like Hunter the Reckonings. And I would just sit there and I would just, everything about those rule books is always still fascinating to me. And also they always had the best like horror stories in them.
Yeah.
Like yeah. The old Vampire the Masquerade, especially since they were snippets. So they would end on these really cool, like just beats that just left you wondering. But like that was the point, you know? And then mixed with like that, the old like Bradstreet art and stuff that used to be in them, you know, like I still adore them. And there's some of my favorite stuff. That and like my collections of like reprints of like old, like 50s like horror comics, like the ones with like all that heavy exaggerated narration and stuff like that. If you like that stuff, there's a great collection called Four Color Fear, if you can find it. It's like 27 non-EC comic like horror stuff, including like a Frazetta comic and stuff like that. But it's just like, it's one volume and it's so much fun. I really recommend it to anyone who likes the old school horror books.
Yes, I'd never heard of that. That's amazing. Because I've been, you know, I go to different stores, you know, looking for, you know, these older comics, you know, especially the horror ones. And they're so hard to find. And, you know, I go into a store and I'll spend an hour like looking through their whole collection and I might find one thing, you know. So that's amazing. I'm going to have to look that up like as soon.
Yeah, no, that one's great. And then there's a book called The Horror, The Horror, which is like has some reprints and then also has like some research in it as well, which is really cool. That one is great because it had like a foreword by R.L. Stine, and then it came with a DVD that's like a half hour or whatever, like film that was like one of the old don't let your children read comics, they all come out like horrible serial killers. And like those two are like some of my favorite like collections. Like I read those the same way like I read like the dramatic narration of like the tabletop like short stories and stuff.
That sounds amazing. I'm excited to look that up now. Like I'm like itching to look it up now, but I'm not going to do that because we're talking. So can you tell us some ways that we can support you as a writer? What can we do as your fans to help you achieve your goal?
I mean, right now it would be two things. I was the editor on the Black Mask comic, The Wilds, by Vida Ayala and Emily Pearson. It's a really great floral apocalypse piece with starring really great queer people of color. If you have access to Comixology or to a comic shop and you can pick up the issues of that, because the more people like that, the more we can do in the future in that world. We've officially announced the collection for sure is going to happen. So if you can't get the single issues, don't worry about that. The Wilds will be in trade, but the more of you pick that up and fall in love with it, the more hopefully we can do in that universe.
And we can call and we can request that comic shops order that for us.
Yes. So at this point, I think all the order periods are done for the issues, except maybe the last issue. But the collection's coming out, so you can definitely ask your comic shops, you know, say, hey, when The Wilds comes out, I want to get that. I want to make sure that you guys are going to have it in stock. You know, and it's just a really great story. Emily's art is amazing. Marissa's colors are phenomenal. You know, I'm super biased, but Vida, you know, is a pretty good writer. You know, Jim Campbell on letters. But I absolutely adore working on that book. And I think it's an important book that does a lot, that deals a lot with the both emotional and physical labor that people of color have to do, but in a very weird and different apocalypse. Like I said, there's flower zombies. So that's the first thing. And the second is, honestly, keep an ear out. I've got things that I'm hopefully are in the mix that are coming up that I can't wait to tell people about. So just keep an ear out. And if you like what I, you know, end up talking about, I really hope that you pick it up when it comes out, or, you know, tell everybody you know to pick it up. You know, that's nice too. If you can afford it. If you can't, just letting other people know that they might be interested in it. And always recommend to me Cool Black Horror. You can just always come and tag me and say you read a Cool Black Horror book and I will flip out and read it, and it will inspire me to write more cool stuff.
Well, see, that's where you messed up right there, because now I'm just going to tell you all the things I've ever read, and your to-be-read pile is going to grow.
That's my to-be-read pile should always be larger than I could ever possibly read, and that's fine.
You know, I think that's an excellent attitude to have. Like, everyone should have that attitude. So I will put links to more information about The Wilds in the show notes for everyone to read a little bit about that, and, you know, some information on how you can request that from your library or your local comic shop.
Much appreciated.
Where else can we follow you online other than on Twitter?
I mean, Twitter is pretty much where it's at. I technically have a Facebook, but it's just to let my aunts and uncles know that I'm alive. So Twitter at WereDogs, you already spelled it out, is where I spend a good amount of time. And I'm pretty open to being tagged and talked to. I like meeting people on the internet because it's less anxious and anxiety inducing than in person. But yeah, I'm always up to talk, reading, writing, editing. It's all constantly exciting and fun. Or even if you just are like, hey, I'm playing video games, you should try this, because I also play a lot of video games. So people should also recommend those to me.
Excellent. What are you playing right now?
Oh, I just finished the plot for God of War, which was phenomenal. I went on this like binge of like of dads who have difficulty communicating. So I've been playing God of War, and I'm doing a bunch of the post-game stuff right now. And we'll probably then go back and play Yakuza again, because I discovered the Yakuza series back in April when they started remastering it. And the second game comes out at the end of the month. And I am obsessed with those games. They do a really cool mix of like really like serious writing and then complete goofball off the wall nonsensical stuff. And I really like that when playing, for the most part, if I am in the mood for like super gut punching emotional stuff, it's there. But I can also literally run around for 3 days straight playing a cabaret club management sim, which is what I did when I first started playing the games, when I discovered that this was a thing. But I've been playing those ones, and then my girlfriend is playing Octopath Traveler, and I've been watching her play that, and that game is also amazing if you like old school RPGs at all.
Yes, I love all of them. The thing is about doing these interviews with authors is every time I hear about something amazing that I hadn't heard of, and so like I have this list of things that I want to do and explore and read now, but I'm like, I have to do the podcast. So you guys should definitely take advantage of all of these wonderful recommendations, because you don't have a podcast episode, presumably, to get out. So enjoy it.
And if you do, you can use all of these things as a reward for finishing the podcast.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I have a long list of rewards at this point. So, Dani, is there anything else that you want to tell us about? Anything else that we should be keeping our eye out for?
We're still going through Slush, but I'm still incredibly excited for the final issue of Faya for the year. That theme is pilgrimage. And while submissions are closed, it's very exciting. So I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. So I'll put a link to subscribe to Faya magazine in the show notes as well. So one other thing that I wanted to do today is, you know, this is the first time that I've had an opportunity for the author to hear their work being performed on the podcast before I interviewed them. Usually it's kind of the other way around. So I wanted to hear kind of what that experience is like to hear your work out there in that world and, you know, seeing people comment on it and, you know, how it made you feel.
It is incredibly surreal. From like within the first like line of the piece, there's like this the sound effect, there's the scratchiness of the comms, and to actually hear that with the dialogue was just, I had to pause it like almost immediately. Like just to hear it from beginning to end was such a wild experience for me. There was definitely a point in my life where I was like, the closest I will ever get to an audio recording of anything I will ever write is asking my girlfriend to read this out loud to make sure it makes sense. But I mean, one, the voiceover was just amazing, and it's really interesting, having not had conversations about how the sentences were supposed to go, because like I think of myself as like a really kind of controlling when it comes to pacing of a story. Like I'm very big on, you know, where paragraphs begin and end, you know, like that one sentence paragraph here, like that sort of thing to control pacing. But it was really interesting when there would be paragraphs and hearing the story read sometimes in the way that I exactly imagined it, being like, holy shit, I can't believe like it reads the way that I want it to read. But then other times hearing it read not quite the way that I imagined it, but it's so much better for that being how it's read, you know, like, and that in itself is an exciting collaborative experience that I don't usually have telling a short story, for the obvious reasons. In some ways, it's a little like seeing the art for a comic page for the first time that you wrote, and seeing how someone else interprets your work and makes the performance of it and their own. Like in this, it's audio, and comics, it's the visuals. But it's for me, it was a similar experience the first time that I'd ever seen someone, like someone ever sent me a character design for a character that I came up with.
That sounds really cool. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. And it's nice to be able to talk to an author after they've heard the performance. So thanks, Dani, again so much for joining us today. and telling us about all these wonderful comics and games and books to read. And best of luck with all of your work. And I hope to have another one of your stories soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.